I'd say the second part, which we don't spend enough time on, and I think you need to spend more time on, if you are going to be in a leadership role and you want to be a strong leader, is spending time on nurturing people for future roles. It's not always about what they do today, but what is it that you're selling to them in 2 years' time? What is it that they're looking forward to in 4 years' time that keep them interested to work here today?
Welcome to Real Leadership, the podcast that cuts through the noise to focus on leaders who make, move, and process things in the real economy. Together, we'll discover the strategies and hard-earned lessons from pragmatic, gutsy leaders who operate in a world that is more steak than it is sizzle. Right here, we dive into their stories, challenges, and triumphs to go beneath the surface to the very heart of leadership in the real economy. I'm your host, Jim Weaver, Chief Operating Officer of the ONI Group, where we believe that real leadership does indeed matter. Let's go. Understanding your labor market is crucial for successful recruitment. Onin Staffing's Recruitment Strategy Guide provides insights specific to your geographic location and the positions you're hiring for. Our Recruitment Strategy Guide delivers a clear snapshot of your labor market and actionable intel to tackle market-specific challenges. With Onin's expertise, we help you navigate and win in your competitive landscape. Empower your recruiting process with the insights you need. Learn more about Onin's Recruitment Strategy Guide at oninstaffing.com/strategy. Today, my guest is Chris McConaughey, the Chief Financial Officer of National Grid. You know, this pod is about leadership in the real economy, and National Grid is the invisible force driving our economy as a global utility, specializing in electricity and gas. With headquarters based in London, National Grid is one of the world's largest investor-owned energy providers. The company serves millions of customers over in Great Britain and here in the northeastern United States, including New York, where Chris is based. Chris received a Master's of Science in Economics from the University of Edinburgh in the UK and launched his early career at Northern Rock and PwC. Chris came to National Grid in 2008. Since then, he's journeyed through various vice president roles and has risen up to the Chief Financial Officer role in 2021. Welcome, Chris.
Jim, firstly, thank you for having me on the show, and just hearing you talk about my my career today is already firstly making me feel a little old. But thank you for the intro.
A little old? Oh, that wasn't the goal.
I feel like I'm on the second page of my resume now, so I'm definitely feeling a little bit more seasoned in my career. So thank you for that.
Yeah, good. You know, I think most people, myself included, have a pretty vague idea of how electricity gets to the outlets, how gas gets to our stove. So if you wouldn't mind, big picture, can you explain the major components and the major players of the electric grid, the power grid in the United States? Can you kind of lay that framework out for us?
Yeah, happy to do so. It's if you think about the size and scale of the utility sector, it can often be often misunderstood or not clearly understood, the varying component parts. So I'd probably break it down into, you know, three major categories. Firstly, generation. Those are the power stations, whether gas, coal, nuclear, solar, wind, generation, that is effectively allowing you to produce electricity to provide to both commercial and residential customers. You then have what is traditionally known often as your local distribution companies, which are obviously, which can also be transmission companies at the same time. So what I mean by that is those providers and companies that build, often own, and often operate the networks that take the power from generation all the way to the substation and quite often to the end user, either a residential or commercial customer. And then the third piece within that, in very simple terms, can be the retail side of it. Often the local distribution company, but can often be third parties who are buying and selling the power to then provide and sell to customers. Quite often, companies like National Grid will play the distribution and transmission role. So that is large voltage from generation all the way down to lowered voltage at distribution. And then we will often be the provider to the customers. So National Grid is the transmission and distribution operator in New York. We're one of about five or six utilities in New York. And we provide effectively the infrastructure that is going from source generation all the way to the 4 million customers that we serve, predominantly in downstate New York, around Central Hudson, and all the way across to Buffalo, New York.
I'm just curious, how many different generation partners do you work with? Is it just a couple, or is it dozens? I have no idea what that would look like.
I would say it's dozens to hundreds. Wow. On the electric side, you have independent system operators, which tend to regulate, I would say, the flow of generation that comes on and off the network on any given day. So they manage the flow of power in each of the areas of the US that they operate. So in New York, we have the New York ISO, and they will be drawing capacity from nuclear sites, from coal sites, not as many in New York, gas-fired power stations, a lot of hydro that comes from upstate. Mm-hmm. You tend to see the power flows in New York tends to be generated in the northern part of the state, particularly as you border Canada, mm-hmm. with, as most people would guess, most of the load coming down towards the kind of metro, New York City, Brooklyn, Queens part of the state.
And you have the infrastructure that moves that energy from the north to the southern part of the state.
That's right. That's wow. right. And it's humbling and impressive when you go out into the field and see some of this infrastructure that is both takes multiple years to design and multiple years to build and install. That is moving large amounts of capacity from mid Hudson all the way down to all the way down to New York City, and just the level of, I'd say, the level of reliance placed on these assets and what they're there for is it's humbling to see when you spend time with the engineers and those folks in the field and the crews that are supporting these assets on any given day.
Recruiting top talent is tough. Onan Staffing focuses on people, offering exceptional benefits to attract and retain dedicated workers. Partner with us for flexible, data-driven solutions. Visit onanstaffing.com to learn more.
My goodness. I was talking actually yesterday. It's something that comes up a fair amount, but we work a lot with auto manufacturers, and a lot of them have really gone all in on EV, and a lot of them have been really disappointed at the slow sales. And I think some of that, I suspect, and you could provide insight, be great, but I suspect some of it is the grid not really being quite there to support EV vehicles. I think people have thrown out, I've heard things like, when you rapidly charge a vehicle at one of these stations, it's the power that it takes to power, 300 houses. And if you plugged in 10 of them in a city, take the whole grid down. So what is the reality of the readiness of our grid for EV? What are the choke points? How do you look at that? What do we need to put into place to be ready for this EV transition that we seem to be underway?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I would summarize my answer to the tail end of your question. What do we need to put in place? I would say a lot. And let me unpack that. If you think rolling back 15 years, you could pretty much predict, depending on the size of a house, what level of load it was going to use in any given winter or any given summer. You can make statistical estimates of how many people are in the house, what the load's going to be based on the weather. You roll forward to 2024, and all of a sudden you've got a whole bunch of bells and whistles that are being tagged onto this house, which make that planning a lot harder. Is this 2,000 square foot house going to have three EVs? Is it going to have a ground source heat pump? Is it going to charge on an evening, or is it going to charge during the day? Not to say that is impossible to solve for, but you've created this world where you have a lot more variables in how you think about designing the system. You also have to look at, well, where is that penetration of EVs going to be? So am I going to plan for deep penetration of EVs in the Adirondacks and every residential household is going to be plugging into four EVs? Or am I going to assume that's going to happen on Long Island? So your planning capability needs to improve and be far more sophisticated in this world, because what you then have to do is, well, how do I support the network, improve the network, improve capacity and resilience to be able to support that build out? So one of the key challenges of this generation, and so over the next 10 years, is how do we keep pace with that growth and build the infrastructure and improve the infrastructure to be able to support that? That's the first thing. And then the second thing is making sure that we have the infrastructure to build in the right place to support where people want to charge those vehicles. And that's not a perfect answer, right? Because you can put plugs anywhere on your house, but it doesn't mean that they're going to be in the optimal place to use them. So it's, again, it's not like we've had 100 years to practice where we put EV chargers. So we're trying very hard with our peer utilities and our regional planning bodies to be able to think about where the right places to put these chargers, so that we do have the infrastructure in place that people can charge quickly. When they travel, they can equally charge. I will say the infrastructure, particularly from a fast charging standpoint, I wouldn't say it's keeping pace, but you see a lot of fast charging popping up all over the place. So we are, you know, and it's not just grid that has to do that. We are really looking at, like, where do we serve this load, and are we building quick enough to support it? But it does create complexity in terms of how we think about improving the network. No different to how we think about generation. If you think historically, nuclear, coal, gas-fired power stations, large scale, providing large, I'd say, large load into the grid. Now you've got a lot of distributed kind of renewables, whether it's smaller scale solar, wind, that you're trying to patch into a level of infrastructure that was designed to go one way from generation to need. And now it's kind of, I would say, more disaggregated. So you think about how do you build a network and pre-build the network to accommodate where you think renewables are going to appear on the network. So again, our planning capabilities have to improve exponentially. Our ability to forecast this also has to improve exponentially.
Do you see much near-term hope of being able to do that? I mean, the way you lay it out, it's like, yeah, I agree, but my goodness, what's the, it's kind of a chicken or the egg analysis that has to happen, right? Like and the drive to put that infrastructure into place will not be there until there's the demand. But the demand is, I think, squelched right now because there's at least the perception that the infrastructure is not ready for it.
Yeah, I think it depends by state. Each state's in a different level of maturity in terms of where they are in that journey. I'd say in New York specifically, there is a lot of legislation and a lot of policy that's driving, I'd say, the right level of investment to make sure that we are at least looking to keep pace, or at least forecasting demand on the network a lot faster than we used to be, let's say, 5 or 6 years ago. But it is going to be a bit of a chicken and an egg situation for a while. But I'd say that there are the right policy incentives and the right policy goals to start to build out the network. If you look, for example, we spend roughly about $1 billion a year in our New York electric business in terms of capital. One of the big pieces of legislation in New York is how do we unlock more spending to be able to support the connection of renewables and unbottle some of these capacity constraints. That level of investment over the next 5 years just to do that is around $3 billion for our business. So if you think we generally spend $1 billion a year, that's pretty much almost doubling what we spend a year to support keeping pace with how do we support the electrification of our, you know, both heat, generally both heat and transport.
I guess some of this legislation gives you a level of predictability, right? You know, they're saying by this, in this time frame, you know, we need to produce this much, or we need to have this availability, or this type of that does give you at least some sort of ability to forecast where we're headed.
That's right. I'd say I would say the legislation drives the policy, and then the policy then drives the regulatory framework that allows us to build and recover that spend over the right period of time.
Struggling with high turnover and burnout? Onan Flex addresses these challenges head on, offering a scalable solution with vetted part-time talent to fill staffing gaps. Onan Flex combats worker shortages and ensures your core team isn't overburdened, reducing turnover and enhancing job satisfaction. Empower your workforce and boost your success with Onan Flex. Visit onanflex.com to learn more.
You know, a lot of the, you know, most people care about the environment and keeping this beautiful planet viable and beautiful. It seems like sometimes we can go off half-cocked with our policy and plans. It's interesting, you know, seeing Germany recently, you know, they had really shifted green, and then they had just one major source for natural gas coming from Russia, and then the Ukraine war happened, and it put them in a really tough spot. These decisions have ripple effects, unintended incentives and consequences. So what do you think is the proper way to transition to renewables? What's the time frame in your mind, or what, and what's the practical real world way of doing this without totally gutting our economy and sort of having all this collateral damage from moving too fast?
That's a great question. And I think, you know, along with many of our peer organizations, Grid's quite well placed to be able to, I would say, answer that, or at least contemplate the dynamics of that, because we own and operate an electric network, and we also own and operate a gas network. So we can see both sides of that equation. I think, you know, there's a couple of things that I think will drive how quickly electrification moves, but how safe that is from a energy security. So firstly, it's going to come down to affordability. You know, electrifying everything over a short period of time is not a cheap thing. You can often look at certain towns and certain parts of the network and say, if you moved away from something like a natural gas and you flipped over to full electrification of heat and power, sometimes that can cost 3, 4, 5, 6 times as much. And if you think, if you're doing that across every piece of the network, that's not a cheap bill, because ultimately customers have to pay for it. So affordability is key to how fast this will go. I think secondly, and it's along the same lines as affordability, you have to think about the energy mix and security, right? Germany was a good example, making sure that you transition in a multi-commodity way, which means you still retain some of the integrity and ability to utilize the networks you've already got. You know, gas network in the US is a good example. It's got fairly good penetration. It's a safe heat source at the same time as it's an affordable heat source. And if you all of a sudden switch from that to electrification, and you do that with renewables, you've got to make sure those renewables aren't going to be intermittent, and that there's some level of storage that goes with it. Because in a big storm, and in those climates where you have extremities of weather, when your electric system goes down, if that's all that you've got, yeah, you can end up in a pretty bad spot. So I think affordability is the first one that comes to mind in terms of the pace of it. And then secondly, the practicalities and energy security of it. And then I'd say lastly is constructability. So your electric networks, no different to other networks, are going to take up just as much space to electrify as something like a gas network. So you've got to make sure that you are able to construct a network over the time frame that you're expecting to electrify. You know, the electric network in the US, not dissimilar to other countries, didn't happen overnight. It's over, you know, I'd say 120, 130 years, you know, to get to where we are today. If you're asking that network to take on another five times the load, you need a very different network to be able to do that. So you've got to be very measured on how you think about the constructability of that and over what time horizon you do it.
Yeah. The reality is right now, electrifying is not cleaner than gas. At least that's, correct me if I'm wrong, but it's coming from coal, it's coming from hydro primarily, right? So, I mean, that gas is actually on the clean scale, it's pretty far up there. Do you think that realistically wind and solar can replace those, or, you know, within the next 20 years can replace significantly those carbon-based energy sources, or, you know, the small nuclear plant idea is very interesting to me. I think that's probably the most viable option. What are your thoughts on that?
I think you know, in the next 20 years or next 20, 30 years, you can see a significant amount of reduction in fossil fuel activity or fossil-based fuels to support both heating and, to support heating. You could see a lot of that replaced by electrification, particularly in those, I call it temperate states, where your colds, you know, aren't too cold and hot's not too hot. I think where you start to get into those states where you've got extremities of weather in the winter and summer months, that's where it becomes a lot harder to do. And your need to build a network to support that on the electric side starts to become more cost prohibitive. I think having a balanced network that allows you to draw natural gas and other sources at the same time as heavy electrification is becomes one of those, I would say, optimal. It's not as impactful from a reduction of carbon emissions, but you get significant reductions from it, but at a level of affordability that most households will be able to afford over the next 20, 30 years.
Right.
And I think, the one thing I just add is you also have to remember that the energy sector is not, or I'd say the need for both power and heat is not a sector that is necessarily focused on a certain customer. We're not serving retail customers. We're not selling chocolate. We are effectively serving every demographic of the population. So you have to make sure that if you are building a statewide network or a federal network, that you have to keep that in mind because you are trying to serve the needs and wants of the whole population and not just one client base. So I'm, you know, the one thing it's one of the reasons why I would say I thrive and enjoy being at National Grid is you have such an influence on that energy transition, but making sure that you do it, that you keep every customer segment in mind, you know, those undocumented customers, those customers, low-income customers on affordability programs, those are the folks that you have to keep in mind when you think about that energy transition. Because high net worth individuals can afford EVs. They can afford Tesla power packs. They can afford solar on the roof, right?
Yeah.
It's those older properties, rental properties that are supporting in areas low-income families. It's making sure that when we think about the energy transition, it is just and keeps everyone in mind.
Facing sudden growth or limited by traditional financing? Momentum Capital Funding empowers businesses with real-time cash flow through AR factoring. Get the funding you need and fuel your success. Visit MomentumCapitalFunding.com to learn more.
You grew up in Edinburgh, UK. If people didn't notice, you have a little bit of an accent going there. So clearly not born here. Tell us about your path from Edinburgh to being CFO of a New York utility company. How did that happen?
So Jim, I'll cover off the stocks. I was actually born and raised in Newcastle, England. I then went and did a postgrad in Edinburgh, but I've been in and around the Northeast pretty much the first 23, 24 years of my life. So born and raised in Newcastle, England. Parents still live there. Got an older sister. I spent pretty much the from about 7 to 18, other than going to school, I played a lot of tennis. I actually played a lot of sport, but I focused on playing tennis. And I say that because that gave me the opportunity to travel the UK and actually travel overseas. First came to the US. I'd say during that time, I had the opportunity to meet so many different people. Coached in the US, played in Georgia at a school there for a year, thoroughly enjoyed it. But during that time, I got exposure to a lot of different people from a lot of different backgrounds and also a lot of different professions. And that probably started to sow the seeds for me on just how I thought about my career and where I wanted to go. I probably started the earlier part of my 20s actually wanting to go into academia. Hence, I did a postgrad. I was teetering on staying in school, but then spent the first 3-4 years of my career in financial markets at Northern Rock. And if you don't know Northern Rock was the first UK mid-sized bank mortgage lender that went into insolvency after the kind of Bear Stearns collapse. Mm-hmm. And I had the opportunity to, I would say, experience some of that. I would say 2 years into my career, it was probably the best learning experience I've ever had. I will say that just what I got exposed to and the opportunity to interact with, you know, senior civil servants, Bank of England, execs was a opportunity that I'm glad it didn't pass me by. And I had it was a good learning experience. I would say within about 3-4 years into my career, I was definitely a financial markets fan, loved everything about it, credit, government, FX, money markets, you name it. I loved how everything moved. The one thing I could never quite get myself into was just the outcome of that, or what was it and what was I getting from it and what was society getting from it. Hence one of the reasons why coming to an organization like National Grid and being here for 14 years has been a great place for me, because I still get the opportunity to play in that space, still get the opportunity to thrive and survive in the world of finance. But at the same time, I do it in an organization that, you know, isn't just selling something. It is there providing a service to society at the same time, particularly the past 2-3 years, and even more so kind of going forward, has a key role to play in how we navigate society through this energy transition.
Yeah, it's an interesting spot to be in, I'm sure. What does the job scorecard look like for a CFO at a big, you know, utility company like yours? How is your performance measured? I'm just curious about that.
I'm sure folks will be listening to the answer to this question. If they listen to any of this, they'll listen to the answer to this question. I'd say first and foremost, the bread and butter is financial performance. So firstly, looking at what have we committed to the street, and what have we committed to investors, and are we delivering on it? So that's a steady earnings growth. It's steady capital investment. It's no big surprises. We're not a highly volatile business. It's about building long life assets and doing that in a safe and reliable way. So that's kind of, I'd say, core financial metrics: operating profit, rate based growth, earnings growth. Yeah. I'd say second to that, which isn't often talked about, but is a key part of what we do at Grid, is minimizing the growth in cost on our customer base. You know, our job is to build, own, and operate assets that are delivering as much as they possibly can in the safest possible way at the lowest possible cost. So we have a lot of metrics that looks at what is the bill impact of what we're doing at National Grid. So our job is not to raise utility bills. Our job is to build assets, own, operate, and deliver those assets in the lowest cost and safest way. So we spend a lot of time looking at the impact of what we do on customer bill growth. That's the second piece of it. And then I'd say the third piece of it, which I think is near and dear to most CFO's heart, is making sure we've got the right governance and control environment in place and in the organizations that we serve. So we spend a lot of time on control environment and making sure those are operating effectively, because we know when we have that and when they are operated effectively, it leads to good outcomes without cleaning up past problems.
Yeah. So the job, obviously you have to have technical expertise. You also have to be somebody that people follow, right? It's not just a technical job. Maybe less than half of it is the technical aspect. And a lot of it, I would imagine, is like any leadership gig, is you have to have people follow you. So what do you think it takes? What's your philosophy around leader? What does it take to be a good leader in your mind?
The amount of hours and time folks could spend answering this question, I don't think there is one, you know, simple answer to being a good and effective leader. But the things I've generally valued over the years in leaders that I've worked for and what I've felt have worked for me is probably a couple of things. I think the first one is you have to be human and you have to care. You've got to surround yourself with teams that you care about and you want to grow and you want to nurture. Yes, the day job's important. Yes, the outcomes are important. But if you can bring more of that self to work and more of that caring and compassion and humility, you build a really strong team. And that's quite hard to do sometimes, because sometimes you are focused very tactically. But I've found it's always been the recipe that I've really thrived in, i.e. when I see leaders operating that way, I've tended to work harder. I've wanted to give more of myself to the role. And equally, I try and pride myself on building that environment and building a team that if we have challenges, I'll be open about it. But more importantly, I'll show a level of interest in what they are and who they are and what they do, that actually, you know, they have a desire to work within the New York finance team. I'd say the second part, which we don't spend enough time on, and I think you need to spend more time on if you are going to be in a leadership role and you want to be a strong leader, is spending time on nurturing people for future roles. It's not always about what they do today, but what is it that you're selling to them in 2 years' time? What is it that they're looking forward to in 4 years' time that keep them interested to work here today? So we tend to spend a lot of time focusing on the future and where somebody wants to go, not next month, but where they go in 2 years' time. Those are probably the two things I tend to focus on. And then the third thing, which I've learned more so over the years, particularly over the past 3, 4, 5 years, is just giving people the space to grow and trusting them and then helping them with the mistakes.
Finding experienced, vetted aerospace contract workers ready to work with highly specialized skill sets isn't easy. Onan Aerospace can help with a wide pool of the best talent attracted through our superior benefits. To learn more, visit onanaerospace.com.
Do you, back on the development planning, do you have a formal process, or is that more of an organic activity that that's just top of mind and you're doing a lot of that?
We have, the great thing about Grid, and I've benefited from it greatly over the years, is we do have a formal process that when we think about performance, we think about, you know, annual performance, which is the stuff that you're doing this year to deliver outcomes. We separate out development, because quite often development plans become annual plans. You know, if you asked 20 people to put a development plan together for this year, I'd say 80% of the things on that development plan actually end up being annual performance plans, which I think you need to separate. There will be some elements of it, but we do have a very separate process, which really looks at what is it that you're looking to achieve in next role or next role but one? What are those capability areas that you and your line manager agree are the things that will help you get there? And then tactically, what are you doing about it? I tend to move away from annual development plans and have kind of rolling two, three-year plans, because if you're doing things this year on a one-year development plan, you become quite tactical. So I like to have plans that folks are working on something for this year. They're actually working on something that is the first step to helping them on something that they want to deliver next year, and then so on and so forth. And then the last thing I'll say is I don't like folks focusing on what do they need to do to get to the next role. I tend to center it more on what do they need to do to get the next but one role.
Right, right. Have you ever read Reid Hoffman's book, The Alliance?
No.
He's the founder of LinkedIn, if the name doesn't ring a bell, but he wrote a book called The Alliance. And it just philosophically, it sounded a lot like that. We have a tour of duty framework that we have. It's a 3 to 5 year development plan framework. And it's philosophically, I'm very aligned with you. And that book had a lot of impact on me. It's a great book. Let's wrap it up with one final parting question. So we have a lot of younger folks listening. If they're listening to business podcasts, leadership podcasts, they probably got some ambition. So what would you tell your, what advice would you give your 25-year-old self now that you have the mileage that you have on you and the lessons learned? What advice would you give your 25-year-old self?
Three things. First one, be even more curious than I was when I was 25. So look at different parts of the business. Be curious about what goes on in those parts of the business. Want to learn more and more each year that goes by. I think curiosity gets a lot of people in a lot of different places. I'd say second, but complementary to that, is build relationships and build real relationships. You know, get to know people on a human level, not just a corporate kind of work level. Want to surround yourself with people that you want to build relationships with, because those networks will last you for years. I had the opportunity when I was at Northern Rock to build a lot of really strong relationships until the bank went bust. And about 80% of those relationships disappeared. But the 20% that I built the strongest relationships on a very personal level are those relationships that I still have today.
Wow.
And then I would say, lastly, and probably most importantly, which I have both failed at and succeeded at over the years, is take every bit of leadership and work advice in the context in which it's given. I don't think there's ever bad advice in the workplace. But if you don't know in the context in which it's given or where that person has come from, you can take that advice and do really bad things with it. So try and unpick the background of, hey, where did Jim come from? He's telling me to do this role next for these reasons. But there's probably a reason behind that, and it probably comes with it, something that he did in his past or a decision that he made. So take every bit of advice you get, but take it in the context in which it's given and try and unpack the path, because that will be super powerful in allowing you to use every bit of information that you get from those around you.
Yeah.
That's a lot for a 25-year-old to do. So hopefully my 25-year-old self is listening to that and can actually execute on all three.
That's great advice. All right. Well, it's been fun, Chris. How can folks find out more about National Grid and, connect with you? And we'll put it in the show notes, but if you want to run it down real quick, that'd be great.
Three things. I'd say National Grid website, investor relations, huge amount of information on both the energy sector and National Grid, always worth reading. Second thing, look at your local independent system operator, the ISO, because when you look on those websites, they have a huge amount of education information about networks. That's the second thing. And then thirdly, organizations like the AGA, American Gas Association, or EEI on the electric side, again, a huge amount of good information on helping you understand both the generation side, transmission and distribution and retail. And I think the more people that are educated on how our network works, the better decisions we're going to make about the energy transition.
All right, you curious people, go get it.
Thank you, Jim.
Yeah, thank you. Until next time.
Thank you for listening. This podcast was powered by Onan, a family of staffing companies providing real staffing solutions to manufacturing, logistics, and food processing companies across the United States of America. To get in touch or learn more about partnering with an Onan Group company, visit us at www.onangroup.com. Thanks for tuning in. Until next time.